Good afternoon. My name is Russ Newberg. I am Program and Evaluation Coordinator for Canyon Ranch Institute. And this afternoon, I will be telling you about a project that Canyon Ranch Institute is working on to build a roof garden in the South Bronx, New York. And just real briefly, Canyon Ranch Institute is a nonprofit public health organization that works with community-based partners to bring health and wellness programming to people in underserved communities and in the United States, and we've also had done a project in Peru. So now I'd like to focus. Let me get the arrow out of the way. And here's a map you can see of the five boroughs of New York City, and the area that the site of the garden will be is in South Bronx, circled here, and give you a little bit of background on what it's like to live in the South Bronx. The South Bronx is the poorest congressional district in the United States, overwhelmingly Hispanic, also a good amount of black residents as well. Almost half of the residents there live below the poverty level. And also significant to our process was the fact that many are born in another country, and not in the U.S., not in New York City, so they come with a different perspective. And also, kind of along with that, goes to show that 57% of residents speak in a language that is other than English in the home. And talking about health, like great struggle across the country, 2 out of 3 adults are obese or overweight, and they're not exercising very much. As you can see here, 56% of adults report exercising 0 days per week, so not at all. And also, diabetes and asthma are also significant issues in this community, and nearly 1 in 10 adults suffer from serious psychological stress. And as relates to this whole session topic, I'd like to focus on green space. The map here is kind of a cutout of a New York City Department of Parks and Rec map that has identified the outlined area here as where the site of the gardens within this area, and this is an area that is not well served by green space. This area there's not people who live here, it's hard to get to experience nature, to experience open space. And if you take a look at the table here, as you can see, you know, the Bronx overall is doing okay. But the area we focus on, where this garden is located, is this Hunts Point Mott Haven area, which is only 6.7% open space. So compared to around 30 for New York City as a whole and the whole entire Bronx borough, it's not very much. And I'd like to talk now about the site of the garden. This is at a community health center, a federally qualified community health center, and called Urban Health Plan. Canyon Ranch Institute has been partnering with Urban Health Plan since 2007, bringing health and wellness programming to the community there. And they do good work. It's a community hub. It's a place of safety and of a place where you can go to just if you have a basic question. And it's highly regarded by the community. And they serve a lot of people, over 40,000 people annually. And in our collaboration with them, they've created a health and wellness center. The process for creating a green space here at this community health center has been quite intentional, and so it started out with, well, what do we know about green space? What do we know about creating a garden? And so thought, you know, do like you always do, go through the literature, and so we created a literature review, which was published, and also we wanted to know who lives in this community, what do they want, what will their experience be in a garden, and what are they really looking for? And so we conducted community focus groups with a variety of people, including staff of the health center, community leaders, and other groups who'd be interested. And then we took the information from the literature review and the focus groups we conducted, and we held workshops with the whole team, people from our partner organization, Urban Health Plan, along with Canyon Ranch Institute, and with the designers for the space who were going to do the landscape design. And design is where we are now. And so, taking all this information, we're working on the design, but obviously we're not going to stop there. We're going to build the space, and we have ongoing programming with Urban Health Plan, and we would like to implement that into the garden and also get patients and staff to use the garden. And then after we get people in the garden, we want to see how it impacts them, how it affects them, so we'll evaluate the impact on their health. There were two central questions asked when conducting the literature review, and that was, what is it about the design of specific open spaces within urban areas that promotes improvements in human health and well-being? And what methodologies and what indicators are researchers employing to document those effects? And from the literature review, we kind of came up with six design criteria on creating a space that will impact health. These include understanding how the space will be used by the visitors to the space, really making sure that their senses are stimulated when they're there. It's also important to feel safe and secure so that they can, as the next point shows, really feel like they're in the moment, to be in the moment. And again, the culture, as we did with the focus groups, identify what they're looking for and how it can best relate and be relevant to that culture. And also, we want the space to really evoke nature, be different from the urban jungle that they're living in. In addition to the design criteria, we came up with characteristics that are key to focus on. And, for example, the existing site. In our case, it's a rooftop, which comes with weight considerations and much more. Also, again, the intended users and what materials might be used in the landscape. Another one which is important is the space, especially in terms of how one moves through the space. Are there transitions and different experiences at different places within the garden to make them feel like it's a journey, or to really, as I said before, be in the moment? And will there be art in the space? Water features? How will water be represented? And seating, is it a place where we go in groups to sit, somebody to sit alone? All these come into play. The focus groups, this here is a photo of our colleague Maura León, who's conducting a focus group, and we wanted to know what it was like for them living in the South Bronx, and what a garden would look like from their point of view. Now, to get kind of in the mindset and sort of see life as they see it, here's an image. This is actually taken from the top of the building. The roof garden space is actually, I'll show you later, is on a second floor roof of the same building. But, you know, it's muted, dark colors, kind of dingy. It's just brick and concrete as far as you can see, and not a lot of way in terms of relief, in terms of plants or just open skyline. And this is actually looking from the space straight across the street. So you're not looking out your window at a yard or a river or a park. It's this brick wall, and see, local artists haven't appreciated it, and so that's what they've displayed on the building. Here's another look, an aerial footage that highlighted there is the space that's going to be turned into a garden. From center down to the left here is the train, the elevated train, and it's a constant noisy presence. There's a little bit of commercial here, but this is a lot of row houses, several story residential homes, kind of close living quarters, close working quarters, lots of cars, buildings. You got some trees here, but it's part of the streetscape and not so much set apart. And okay, so now that you kind of seen the area that they're living in, this is what they told us they wanted: a quieter environment. Again, the noise of the train and in the traffic, and a place to relax and be outdoors. So this could, and comfortable was emphasized. You know, not just maybe a bench at a bus stop, but something they could really sit and relax. Rocking chairs. The culture comes in here with hammocks and even a hut that they called a bohio. A lot of the people in the community come from the Caribbean, and they still have fresh memories of hammocks and huts and green space. And water, they wanted the sound of water, the sight of water, and perhaps, you know, a fountain or a water wall, and wanted light to emphasize it if visiting in the evening. A place to be social, tables, play board games, or to have a snack. And again, plants. They wanted trees, flowers, and nature is not just in terms of plant life, but animals too, and to see birds, and that it would be a special connection for them to their heritage, many of them from the Caribbean, and also a place to settle down from the hustle and bustle and to meditate. Here's a view of the space. Here you got this is a protective layer covering the waterproof membrane. Here this is taken May of this year, and we're going over with the designer and the facilities guy here, and then same view, same buildings. This one is without the covering on it, same roof, and I should also say, you can see the train is right there. This is pretty much eye level, and it's in a stone's throw of the roof, so it's quite noisy. And you can see the view right now. It's very, you know, those buildings, but, you know, talking about, you know, raising that wall and adding a lot of color and, you know, mitigating some of the sound, maybe not all of it, but definitely imagine how a different experience could have a big impact on the folks here. And as we're still in the process of designing, it's kind of just an overview of the design. You can see how it allows for movement, and for the detail reasons, it doesn't have a lot of the plants in it, but the hut there in the corner, group seating area. This is a better view of the color that's really gonna pop in that community. And then on the far wall here, we have kind of, in this image, they're placeholders for perhaps community art or other ways that the community can personalize and customize the space. And a closer up view of the bohio, the hut, and some seating. And here's a view of the color that's from the Caribbean, and also to emphasize that social aspect. Here, it's an example of some art that might be put in place. These are prayer wheels, the idea that the community really wanted to keep in touch with things that were spiritual, and they wanted a place to meditate and something to help facilitate their interaction with the garden. So you've seen some images of what the spaces would like the space to look like, and so when we build it and get people to experience it, also want to measure how it's impacting them and what they're how they're benefiting from visiting the space. And back to the literature review, these are self-reported outcomes that were included in the studies we looked at. And you got some physical, as far as even fatigue and pain, but also a lot of mental health, depression, quality of life, again, spiritual well-being, and stress. However, we did not want to exclusively rely on self-reported outcomes, and these are physical outcomes that we are also likely to use. Body mass index, and also, you know, saliva swabs to measure cortisol levels to take a look at the impact of stress on the body. And so, what did we learn from this? Have we learned from this experience, and what are we continuing to look at? It's really clear that some urban communities, and as is the case with South Bronx, don't have readily available open space to exercise, to meditate, and as a lower income community, they don't have the transportation to travel. There is the Bronx Garden, or the Bronx Zoo and the Bronx Botanical Garden, but those are quite a trip for these folks, and also there's a price tag associated with it. And not only is it not available, but it is highly valued, the open space and experiencing nature for a community like the South Bronx. And because they value it so much and they feel like it would greatly impact them, it's important to include them in on the discussion. And you can see from the example how the colors and the bohio really was key elements of the design, and that was by going directly to the community and finding out what was going to impact them. Thank you very much. My contact information, and ready for the next.
Thank you for those wonderful presentations that expand our thinking of the built environment and how it impacts the public health. So we have about 15 minutes, and we'll take questions to all four of the speakers. Question?
Yeah. Can you talk about the purpose-built communities and how they're growing here in the world? Can you talk
There is one in planning in New Orleans. So these are communities. Purpose-built communities is now an organization and it's working with multiple communities. So I give examples of communities where there is a process has begun in place to establish one. It's not that if I give the impression that all of them were up and running like the Atlanta East Lake, that is not correct. It's places that are developing a purpose-built community.
That's a great question, and the Bronx is a big place, even the South Bronx, there's a lot of people. What's neat is Urban Health Plan, the federally qualified health center, is everybody knows about it in the community. They have multiple buildings and multiple, you know, reach, you know, throughout, also in Queens and some other areas, and so everybody in the community knows about Urban Health Plan. That's the go-to place for where they know they're going to be taken care of, and it's a major resource. So it's really going to be once it gets up and built, people are going to know about it. It's going to be talked about. It's word of mouth. People go in there just to hang out at the community health center just to socialize. And it will be, you know, it's a rooftop garden, so it's limited space, but it's going to be they're going to use it for programming, and but I mean, this is talking, you know, years into the future. This is going to impact people, so they're just going to, you know, keep getting as many people as they can through the space, and maybe they'll, as they see this improve, hopefully in an additional, we can find funding for additional more rooftops on more of their buildings, and then show the impact of this space, and keep talking about it and sharing about it, and hopefully others will be encouraged to build similar spaces so that more people can experience it. And also, it's not just the one, as I showed with the map I showed outlining that's an underserved area in terms of access to parks, shows, you know, the New York Parks and Rec Department is clearly identified that, and I think there's a lot of different people working on it. So we'll impact as many folks as we can in that space, as many hours as there are in the day. We're starting from, well, the project, a rooftop became available at the Simpson Pavilion building. And so, yeah, with the new health center, so we focused on creating a health center. They got a fitness, a gym, and a demonstration kitchen. Now is going to, and the program is going to be used for that. And as part of the new, as the new building went up, identified an opportunity for a roof garden.
That's a really good question. big challenge we have is how do we evaluate the success of these policies and changes to the built environment. And we're working on that. We're trying to come up with a good tool that we could use in our state, and I know that some communities are and states are starting to do that through various tools of how they can evaluate communities on a range of things. But I think with complete streets, certainly you can start to quantify the number of projects that a community has once they've adopted a policy and how many projects are tracking through that policy now and what the impact of that is. So you can start counting those kind of things. Count the number of things like the number of new handicap ramps, or disabled ramps at intersections, how many new linear feet of sidewalk has been put in since they've adopted the policy, how many feet of bikeways have been. So you can start counting that. And that's one thing that we encourage in communities is they start tracking all those things once they adopt a policy, is that they put tools in place that they're tracking those things. So many communities are doing that. Some of them are even doing little dashboards, and they're reporting out quarterly to their Board of Public Works about all of these different complete streets elements that they've counted since they've adopted the plan. So we're seeing some success in that. It's a shift on how they count things. And the issues then with the policy change, say in a comprehensive plan like a land use plan or things like that, that's a little harder because they're all so different. We do have our state statute has a template that you're supposed to use, but it's very basic. So I think it would be a good exercise, say, for a state to do is start doing inventories of, say, comprehensive plans and start surveying communities to find out, do you have these certain kind of health elements embedded into your comprehensive plan? And you could do that through a survey tool or any other ways. I know that the American Planning Association did a national survey a couple years ago about comprehensive plans that have a health chapter in them. So some of that is starting to be done on a national scale, and some states have done that too, but not as much as you'd hope yet. Does that answer? That Indianapolis too, where we had some what you call a road diet, where you have a four-lane road, you take it down to two lanes and add bike lanes. But many times then the bike lanes shift at intersections so bikes can go through them, and those are what I think what you're talking about is where you get these shifts of bike lanes, and it changes the pattern, traffic pattern for drivers. And that's very confusing at first, but what we found is sometimes the city has had to go in and redesign some intersections because they still met federal standards. But this is all new, even for a federal highway, and a lot of their standards had to be changed in the last few years, or there's a learning curve for the civil engineering profession to kind of integrate these ideas. So that's kind of a learning curve a lot of communities are going through, so it's not unusual. Indianapolis is doing that too. And I think that's part of the maturing of the whole Complete Streets movement. I know it doesn't answer your question about how you do quality of Complete Streets. I think communities are getting better at it. Indianapolis went through and restriped some of those roads, and they're a lot better now than their first. But they didn't disappear. But they're kind of redoing them and kind of going and retrofitting some of that. So I think we find that's a natural progression that a lot of communities go through. So it's not unusual. But I think you're right. Eventually, communities need to start measuring the quality of doing these projects, so you're getting better quality outcomes, and trying to really make those interventions where they're needed. Because a lot of times we're seeing this also, a lot of these are in more higher income areas too that aren't necessarily serving the populations that need them. So we're trying to shift the thinking to trying to get these interventions to where people need to bike and walk more, not necessarily in areas where people are already doing it.
Thank you. And Dr. Weiss, I have a question for you. In some of your research, what are some of your challenges to multidisciplinary work engaging So I was asking her about some of her challenges to engaging people outside of her field. Obviously, multidisciplinary collaboration is important, so if you have a second. Okay, thanks.
I'm going to take an academic approach to that because that's our most recent example. When we had two accrediting bodies looking at us in our department, so we were both up for COPART reaccreditation of our REC program and CEEF reaccreditation of our public health program, the public health is so far advanced ahead of so many other professions with language, with expectations, with learning outcomes, with the structure that you need in order to provide a quality educational experience and the way we're supposed to be measuring that, much farther ahead than many other disciplines. And so it's very easy for the public health language and orientation and prerogatives and priorities to trump these other groups, and we can do it because we can. We're big enough that we can. Recreation, for example, coming to us because they really need some of these evaluation skills that we have. They want to understand epidemiology better. They really need to understand both process participatory evaluation as well as objective outside kind of evaluation. So it's really easy when a group is coming saying, we need your skills, we need to be part of you, for us to say, okay, here's who we are, come inside, as opposed to stop and learn about who they are. So the biggest challenge I find is that when you've got, and public health often has the kind of the central role in facilitating a coalition or getting a group together, it's really hard to be humble. It's hard to be culturally humble and allow time for the process, because once you let it go and realize that we need these partners as much as they need us, we get then all of this new language, all of the new skills that they bring.
And I have one final question for Dr. Williams. How can we best engage policymakers to employ this kind of systemic change? So just, I know we only have 2 minutes, but if you can talk about, just briefly comment on that.
I actually think my colleague from Indiana actually told us that the steps that they used in terms of engaging community. Communities are voters, and communities become engaged using community organizations. He mentioned AARP as an example of an organization that has clout, and you get communities engaged and the voice of the community to the voice of representatives. I mean, I think one of the things I would say to public health is that too often I think we are way too passive. I sometimes say to my students that we need to learn from the Tea Party. And I'm 100% serious about that. The percentage of Americans who belong to the Tea Party, who are part of that movement, is actually very small. They're not that large of a group. Yes, they have funding, but much more importantly, they are strategic. They are tactical. They have taken the existing political system where few people participate in primaries. I mean, the recent analysis shows if the people who voted in 2012 had voted in 2014, the Democrats would not have lost the Senate. It was strictly about turnout. And Republicans turned out at much higher rates than Democrats did. So my point is, every congressional office has a staff that monitors phone calls and monitors phone calls on particular issues. Yes, there are powerful economic interests that drive a lot of what happens, but the counterbalancing issue is most members of Congress want to get elected. And if the people within their constituency are demanding issues, they pay attention to it. And that's the one way you can counter the power of money. In the process. So my bottom line is, yes, we absolutely have to get engaged. And I do think we can learn from the Tea Party in terms of thinking of what our priorities are and working in a very strategic way to try to accomplish it. And I certainly think the examples from Indiana are one example, but we could even think in each of us, in our own communities, what are the important issues and how to inform, educate, empower individuals to be much more involved. Thanks.